Well, hello, I'm Paula, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to WAKIPA 15 in Las Vegas. WAKIPA is a Western Area Conference for Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous. Please help me open this meeting with a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The topic for this panel meeting is special interest groups in AA, and I will be asking Katie to read our reading. I just want you to know that I am not Louie. Just want you to know I'm not Louie. Okay? And anyway, Katie, will you read for us?
Hi, I'm Katie, and I'm an alcoholic. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. We are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like the passengers of a great linear moment after rescue from shipwreck when camaraderie join us and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us, but that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. AA Big Book, page 17. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie. Now I'd like to welcome our first speaker, and it is Armando from Tucson, Arizona.
My name is Armando. I'm an alcoholic. Let's start off with what it was like. For me, I started drinking not too young. I know a lot of you have probably started a lot longer than a lot sooner than I did. I started when I was about 14. I remember I asked my mom if she could buy me a 12-pack. She bought me a 24-pack. And I ended up moving out with some friends. Ended up staying with them, and that's what the 24-pack was for. They partied, and they drank, and they got high. So I kind of lived my life like they did, like they lived their lives. I passed through that stage where you would just, you would wake up every day, and you would buy a 40. You'd go to the Circle K, and you'd get, like, a bum to buy you a 40. So that was my life. You know, we drank every day. We got high every day, and it was fun. It was fun back then because I fit in. I fit in, and we ran with I ran with a crew of about four people, and we did stuff like kids. You know what I mean? We went cruising and stuff like that. We did that type of stuff for a long time. You know, I ended up getting a girlfriend, getting her pregnant, the usual stuff. For me, still drinking, still pretty young in my disease, I ended up drinking a lot more. She would piss me off, and I would use that as an excuse to get drunk. I'd be like, okay, now I can drink. Now I'm gonna hurt her. Now I'm gonna show her how I feel. So that didn't make any sense, but it made sense back then. I would hurt her by hurting myself. As the years went by, I think the first time that I knew I had a problem, I was about 21. I had an apartment, and I ended up throwing a keg party, and nobody showed up to the party. I was always that type of person. I was kind of always a loner. But with alcohol, I fit in. I could feel comfortable in my own skin. I ended up flooding, getting drunk, shit-faced, getting in a fight with my sister, and I ended up... sorry, that's a little rough speaking. I ended up flooding the apartment. I got drunk and I broke the back of the toilet. Make a long story short, I flooded the downstairs apartment. I was a real mess. That's when I first suspected that I had a problem. Later on through the years, it just got worse. I would drink every day. And my girlfriend with my baby, she decided, I'm not going to stick with this loser. You know, nobody, I guess she didn't see much of a future. I don't really blame her for that. You know, that's an amends that I'll have to make. It's kind of rough, but it's something that I have to do. Anyway, I kept drinking and drinking. Stuff got worse. You know, I ended up, typical story, losing every job that I had. Ended up drinking the last 10 years of my life really, really hard. The last 10 years of my drinking career. I would drink every day. I was the type of drunk that would buy a 12-pack, and then I would have to hide beer. I don't know why, but I would hide beer underneath the bed, in the closet, that type of stuff. I just needed like another beer to get me through the next day. And if I knew that that was there, then I felt okay. I had to have that backup. After that, I started, you know, doing drugs, the typical stuff, what was my story. Ended up getting really, really bad. And then one day, I finally got so sick after puking, throwing up, looking really lethargic, really yellow. I ended up calling the hotline and I ended up talking to a man, and he goes, there's a meeting right down the road. Can you make it on Saturday morning? I was really ashamed of the way I felt, of the way I looked. I didn't want to meet that man, but I did not want to drink anymore. The pain was so bad. I remember sitting on this stool waiting for that man because the meeting was at a church. And I remember just shaking and shaking and shaking like I am now. It was just horrible. I ended up finally, he said, you know what, I'll sponsor you for a while, but could you, I think there's somebody you could meet here, and I think he could make a good sponsor for you. So that man ended up sponsoring me, and he ended up helping me through the steps, and still helps me today. I've been sober for 3 years, and this program has saved my life. People like me don't get sober. We stay out, we drink, and we die. I had to do what I had to do. I didn't work the steps to the best of my ability. I did the steps to the best of my ability. I did not go to the 90 and 90 like I suggested. I did what I could. I'm glad I didn't have a job when I first got sober, because I probably wouldn't be here today. I could not have wrote it better myself, the way my life has ended up. It has been an amazing journey, and I'd like to thank everybody for coming. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Armando. Now I'd like to welcome our next speaker, Ray M. from Tucson.
We're gonna stick with what is. My name's Ray. I'm an alcoholic. All right. Yeah, my sobriety date is February 25th of 2008, and I'm exceptionally grateful because I didn't know that that was going to be, I mean, today I didn't know that, I mean, on that day I didn't know I was going to get sober and stay sober, because I just knew that that was the day I needed to check my ass into treatment in order to avoid going into prison. So it was, you know, it was those kind of measures that, or what usually took for me to take some form of action. When I was asked to be on this panel, I thought about looking back at my sobriety and looking back at some of the challenges I've had overcome. Like, I realized that, you know, everybody in this program, can definitely, you know, qualify as a special interest. We all have those things and those barriers that really kept us out there for longer than what we probably needed to. And it really just kept us from, it kept us from, like, walking through some of that fear. And, you know, I don't know, I guess I'll start. I can tell you when my first drink was for the effect. Well, actually, I had my first drink when I was a really young kid. And I remember I saw my dad drinking a beer and asked him for a taste. And he gave me a taste of it. And I spit it out and thought it was the nastiest thing I've ever tasted in my entire life. And couldn't understand how anybody would want to consume that thing. So, and that lasted for a while. That attitude of, like, you know, not wanting to take that drink, kept me from not drinking for a while. I reached this point in my life to where I became extremely suicidal. In junior high, I was talking about suicide every day because I knew that if I had talked about suicide, I would get attention from the school teachers and the school guidance counselors. I couldn't get the attention that I sought out from at home, so I would always talk about the stuff in school, and they would send me the guidance counselor. Mrs. Saylor would talk to me, and she would talk me kind of down. And there were only a few times when I was actually serious about committing suicide, and there were only like two times when I actually like made a half-ass attempt. I didn't really make full-fledged attempts because I had two younger brothers that really just were like, you know, the only bright spot in my life at that time, and were just, you know, they were the reasons that I couldn't actually go through with it because I couldn't place that burden on them. I couldn't leave them alone. So, you know, they helped me, like, pull through that dark time. And towards the end of that suicidal phase, like, I was struggling with insecurities. And so I identify as an alcoholic. One of my identities outside of my alcoholism is that I'm a gay man. And I struggled in junior high with this discovery, the self-discovery of this, of my sexuality and realizing that, hey, I'm not the person that I thought I was going to grow up to be. Like, I am here struggling with all these other issues, and now here I am, my path is not going the way that I had planned since I was a little kid. I mean, I don't know about other guys, but when I was growing up, I really pictured just growing up and, like, meeting the woman of my dreams and, like, marrying her and, like, having, like, the house with the kids and the nice fence and the nice backyard and all that stuff. And so this whole, like, new, like, self-realization, like, just completely derailed me. And I started to develop, really big insecurities. And I just felt like I was not masculine enough. I wasn't, you know, I made the mistake of dressing up as a girl for Halloween one time. And, like, a couple assholes called me bitch. And that nickname stuck for a couple months. And that just really, like, humiliated me and just completely derailed me. And so, and, like, I was new to this school, and I was, you know, I still had a personality that, like, you know, that people, like, found somewhat enjoyable, to where I could actually make some friends. But just because they were my friends doesn't mean that I felt like I belonged. And I remember my very first drink for the effect, and that was at St. Henry's Catholic Church. I went to a church lock-in that night. I remember George Fisher and Jason Berry invited me into the bathroom, and we did shots of Jack Daniels in the bathroom at the lock-in. And then we watched Cheech and Chong Up in Smoke that night. And I know that from that, I know that night was, you know, that night alcohol played the role that it, you know, that I liked. I liked the fact that I could sit there and I could drink with my friends and I felt like I belonged. I hated the taste of alcohol, like, and I only drank a little bit, but, like, that night seemed like it was so perfect and I got away with it. Like, you know, I the next day it was, you know, I mean, alcohol served a purpose in my life. It turned my life around from that moment. I don't know if it was that night, but in that period of time, I started to actually, you know, become more comfortable around these people, and my relationship started to blossom. And so I would continue to drink occasionally as much as I could. I came from a very authoritative, like, family. Like, my uncle was very strict and very just, you know, had his thumb on me the entire time of my, you know, upbringing, to where, like, I became a very good liar. And the way I became a good liar was I told myself the lie, so I believed it. And then once I believed it, then I could share it with the rest of the people. Because, like, these, once I believed this lie, then it was no longer me having to keep facts straight and keep stories. There was less chance of me getting in trouble and caught up. And so, like, I started to lie to myself. I mean, and I mean, it was about everything, like, anything. Like, I mean, if I drove, you know, if I made it from point A to point B in 10 minutes, like, and you asked me how long it took me, I would tell you it took 5. It didn't serve any purpose other than the fact that I just enjoyed this routine of, like, if I distort this reality and just believe it myself, then I don't ever have to, like, worry about getting caught up in all the details. I drank casually in high school. I would go out to desert parties. I would drink with my friends, but I wouldn't want to lose control too bad. I only remember one blackout. I was left in the desert alone near a campfire with a bottle of with a fifth of Southern Comfort. And next thing you know, I'm falling out of a truck, hitting my head on the concrete, and I puked so much that I burnt the grass in front of my grandmother's house. That was my only blackout in high school. I had to go to my work. I worked at Pizza Hut the next day, and we were unrolling a new, like, pizza and with the garlic spray, and I puked my guts out that entire day because that garlic spray was horrible. I can tell you I never drank Southern Comfort since then. So, I mean, you know, like, I have learned a few lessons along the line. You know, but the thing is I never came, I denied my identity. You know, I denied who I was, and I was a good conformist. I became overly involved and tried to achieve and excel in everything I possibly could. I, you know, graduated top of my class. I applied for every single scholarship I ever had. I was a cancer survivor, so I applied to any cancer scholarship I could, and I got a bunch of them. I was student body president, and I was on all these sports teams, and it was just that wasn't enough. You know, like, I still felt that there was this void and that there was this insecurity that I couldn't face, and so I just masked all these things by all these other, you know, I just polished the surface as best I could. And I was looking for my ticket away from Buckeye, where I grew up, because it was a small community where everybody knew your business, and I knew if I wanted to explore these things, I needed to get out of town, but I needed to be close enough to where I could still have contact with my brothers. And so I applied for, I saw college as my opportunity, and I decided I was going to go to the University of Arizona, and I went down there on a full ride, and, you know, it was great. I finally had that independence that I always wanted and felt I deserved and I thought I could handle. So I took this whole thing of, like, I moved out. You know, my aunt and uncle did everything they possibly could to derail that. At the last minute, they took away my car. They took away any cash I had. They told me that until they thought I was responsible and ready, that I was not going to college. And I just couldn't see how people could try to control my life like that. I'd worked so hard to get to where I was. And so I basically said, you know what, with or without you, I'm going. And they finally let me go at the last minute. And I went down there and I rebelled a little bit. I, you know, started partying more. I pierced my tongue. And that tongue piercing, you know, was that pivotal moment that, you know, defined my relationship with my aunt and uncle for such a long period of time. They asked me if I was a faggot, and I denied it. They asked me again, and I said, you know what, I don't have to answer to you. They told me to get my shit and get the fuck out of their life. So I did. I obliged. You know, and I turned around, and I walked away from them, and I had to walk away from my two brothers for a long period of time. And I took this stance of independence. My mom had died when I was 11, and my dad was in prison. And, you know, so I didn't, you know, and I, any other family that I had, either they, like, had, you know, they had, in my opinion, in my perspective at that time, they had fucked me over, and, you know, I couldn't rely on anybody, so I told myself, I don't need anybody. You know, I moved down to Tucson, and I went back to Tucson, and I started just, you know, partying as much as I possibly could. And, you know, what I realized was that as I was partying, that I started to, you know, like, I was able to start dealing with my sexuality issues. You know, I felt like the only way for me to actually have any sort of intimate relationship with a guy, I needed to be fucked up, and so did he. So I began to mix alcohol with other, you know, substances, and, you know, just trying to find the perfect cocktail that's going to create this perfect relationship, or at least get me laid. So I continued to do that, and, You know, next thing I knew, I found myself with losing my job, getting evicted from my place. I had burned through any sort of trust fund that I had left, you know, from my mom's, you know, from the death of my mother. And I was at a point to where, you know, I had to drop out of school and I had to move back to Phoenix with the hopes of getting my life together. I moved back to Phoenix, and by this time my dad was out of prison. I moved in with my dad, and I just didn't stay there very long because I was so deep into this disease that I just couldn't bear the guilt of like showing up and, you know, around my family with it. So I would disappear and I would go live with people that that took me in, and there's somebody in this room that like has spent many and many of nights like on the streets with me, like, or in someone's house staying, you know, just staying around. And, you know, I mean, I would just bounce around, like, you know, long enough until I outstayed my welcome, and then I'd move on to the next place. I managed to pick up several, drug felonies and, you know, along the way. And, you know, by what it took for me was that, you know, I was standing in front of the judge for the fourth time facing my fourth felony. And he said, you know, like, you're going to prison. And, like, that scared the shit out of me. Like, I, you know, as a... you know, gay man, like, knowing the stories, like, going to prison really just freaked me out because, like, I'd always had this fear of not being masculine enough. And so for a person who feels like they're not masculine, a prison can be a very scary place. Because I'm not a fighter. Like, I don't know how to sit there and protect myself. So I, out of fear, I listened to the judge, and he gave me a window to where I was told that I could, go check myself into treatment. And so I did. I looked for the shortest treatment center I could possibly find, the little 28-day spin dry. And unfortunately, they were none of them could get me in the time that the judge allowed. So my only option was to go to the Salvation Army. I guess this is where, like, you know, I can tie this into the special interest groups because, I've had my share of, I've already talked about my insecurities with presenting myself and my own identity, and as well as, you know, I've had some exposure to the church, and most of my exposure to the church has not been good in regards to, you know, acceptance of gays and lesbians. So going into this Christian treatment center, you know, I had this content prior to investigation that, you know, they were going to sit there and tell me how wrong I was and how, you know, how I just didn't belong. But I'm going to go in there because I don't want to go to prison, and I'm going to just, you know, do what they tell me to do, and then whenever I leave, I can just completely, you know, do my own thing. Like, I'm not trying to get sober forever. I'm just trying to, like, stay out of trouble, and I don't want to get arrested anymore, and I want to get out from underneath all this wreckage that I had. I checked in the Salvation Army February 26th of 2008. I had to at least be 1 day sober before they'd take me in. And, with $10,000 in restitution and 1,000 hours of community service, my family's house had bolt locks on every single door. Not like, it didn't matter if it was a bathroom, it didn't matter if it was a bedroom, an exterior door, a gate. Everything had multiple locks on it, and none of them, I didn't have a key to a single one. The scary part was that I had to face myself. You know, everything that I'd been masking with the alcohol and with my partying was, I couldn't run from anymore. This is where the special, you know, I don't go to too many gay meetings today. In the beginning, though, the gay meetings served a purpose. You know, because I'm in it immediately, like, you know, just full of fear, and I am not feeling comfortable, and there is no way that I'm going to be willing to share. If I can walk into a meeting where at least I can share this identity that I am full of fear about with some other men who are sharing also this, you know, our common problem, and we all have this desire to get sober, then, you know, there's a better chance that I might stick around. Now, that being said, what saved my ass is mainstream AA. Because if I would have stayed in those rooms and exclusively in those rooms, I don't think I'd be standing here in front of you today sober. It's been my experience that most of those rooms, many of the people, do not stick around for very long. There was an LGBTQ community center in Phoenix where I used to go to meetings, and many of those people, many, many of those people that I've encountered in that facility are no longer sober. I you know, there are a few people that I like that are still sober that I've, you know, friends of mine that I still have contact with. But there are many more that just would come for a few times and then I would never hear from again. And so it was, you know, but what happened is if I stay in that bubble of that, you know, of that, if I stay in that bubble, like I'm not working on myself and I'm not, you know, getting myself outside of this, you know, outside of this fear. So what, you know, what's been most instrumental in my life is, you know, I began to start, I got a home group and I got a men's stag home group, a bunch of biker dudes. They were like, you know, I mean, scary as shit, some of them, but some of them were soft little teddy bears. But, you know, and I started going to this meeting and like I got a sponsor who like basically told me like, you know, it doesn't matter if you're gay or straight. You need to just learn how to have a relationship with a man. Like a friendship, like every guy needs to learn how to have a relationship with a man when they come into this program. And, you know, like that was like a revelation for me because like what my insecurity wasn't so much that I was gay. It was the fact that I didn't know how to have relationships, like in general. Like I use this as my defense mechanism, but like my sponsor told me that, you know, like learning how to have relationships with men inside these rooms is going to carry you throughout your sobriety, you know? And so what I, you know, and when I started looking for these commonalities and, you know, this common solution to, you know, our problem, like I began to realize that like as different as I thought I was because of this like one big thing in my life, like there are so many similarities that I was not, you know, aware of. And so if I had been, you know, if I was afraid and I'd stayed in this little bubble, like my entire, in my sobriety, like, you know, I would be limiting my growth. You know, I was talking to my sponsor about this before I, you know, and about what to share on and, you know, because I really feel, like I said, we're all, you know, we all are special interests. You know, we all belong here for one reason. And you know, we all have our own, you know, unique experience that, you know, oftentimes it's really enjoyable to hear somebody else's experience and be like, oh shit, at least I didn't have to go through that shit. And, you know, and it's like, you know, and I got to hear about other people's experiences with God and, you know, and I had a lot of similarities, you know, like I had resentment towards God because I felt like God was, you know, what everybody else told me he was when I was growing up. God is the punisher. He is the judger, you know, and you are a sinner and you need to live your life according to, you know, this is what God's will for you is. And I, you know, I believed what people told me his will for me was, you know, and I believed that they told me that I was, you know, according to God, that I was going to hell. And, you know, and I believe the part that God had a plan. And if God had a plan, he took my mom away from me and he sent my dad to prison. And you know what? Fuck him. That was my solution. So I had to come in here and I had to hear other people say, look, I fucking hated God too. Maybe not for the same reasons you did, but you know what? Like, I'm pretty desperate. So I at least had to, like, you know, give God a second chance. And what I realized is that God had given me many chances and that I just needed to be, you know, and I believed that he was here. And I wiped the slate clean because I wanted a clean slate myself. And so in prayer and meditation, we made that agreement. And I got to this place in my life, you know, to where I was willing to, you know, I got past the, you know, first step and then I got to that second step, you know, and I made an honest third step. And I don't know, I guess I'm kind of getting off track, but what's important to me is that, you know, that there was a place where I felt like I belonged when I came to AA. And you know what, it started off with one or two meetings. And as I progressed through my sobriety and, you know, and with sharing who I am, you know, it's allowed me to expand that to more groups. And I honestly believe it's my duty to be as open and honest as I possibly can in any group of AA. Because I may not identify with the group, but there may be one person in that group who identifies with me. And if I don't share that experience, then I'm I'm not doing my duty as an alcoholic. So here I am in front of a group of people. I mean, a lot of you I know, some of you I don't. And sharing my experience as far as being an alcoholic who just so happens to be gay. I still have my insecurities, you know, and I still, you know, thank God I don't have to hide behind them or compensate for them or, you know, just, you know, with, you know, the bottle or with any substance for that matter. So, you know, I'm just so glad that regardless of where we come from, that we have one common purpose. I will close with this one little reading from As Bill Sees Shit. And I have to give credit where credit is due. My sponsor told me if you give credit three times, then you can own it. So this is credit number one to my sponsor for helping me, you know, figure this out. But it's from page 24 from the book, and it says, "Alike when the chips are down." It's from a Grapevine edition, October 1959. In the beginning, it was four whole years before AA brought permanent sobriety to even one alcoholic woman. Like the high bottoms, the woman said they were different. AA couldn't be for them. But as the communication was perfected, mostly by the women themselves, the picture changed. This process of identification and transformation has gone on and on. The skid rower said he was different. Even more loudly, the socialite, or Park Avenue stumblebum, said the same. So did the artist and the professional people, the rich, the poor, the religious, the agnostic, the Indians and the Eskimos, the veterans and the prisoners. But nowadays, all of these, and legions more, soberly talk about how very much alike all of us alcoholics are when we admitted that the chips are finally down. So, I'm just so grateful that I'm a part of this amazing fellowship that is so diverse and so inclusive. You know, if it wasn't for that person just sticking out their hand and saying, "Welcome," to every single person, regardless of their, you know, regardless of what baggage they're walking in with. Like, I wouldn't be here today. So, I'm grateful to be here. Thank you.
Thanks, Ray. And now I'll introduce Ray B.
Hello, my name's Ray, and I'm an alcoholic addict. I have to pace when I talk, you know, I can't just sit there. people suggest, you know, you write down what you're going to talk about, this and that. And it's always my intention to do that, but, you know, time always, for some reason, flies. Here, let me see. You know, our stories of what it was like and what it's like now, you know, it's sometimes tragic. Most of the time it's tragic. And a lot of times it's comical. You know what I mean? It's just a trip. And we look back at it and we can laugh. And we can laugh at it, you know. I remember, I had a rough childhood, you know. Ever since I can remember as a child, I always had this nervous disposition. Like something's always, you know, pop out. Something's always going to pop out. You know, my childhood was something like this. You know, we'd all eat dinner and we'd kiss mom and dad good night. And we'd take off our shoes, you know, and we'd all sing Kumbaya, you know, and this and that. And as, you know, as we're falling asleep, all we hear is Ray Adam. And we knew what that was. We didn't even have to look into my mom's room to know that she was getting, you know, beat on. You know, it was just a straight shot. I can't count how many times, just a straight shot to the police department. The police department, like, they see us coming, like, "We'll be over there, don't worry." You know, and there they go, you know. You know, so I remember having this nervousness, you know, not being comfortable in my house, you know, because something's going to pop off. So I remember for a long time I slept with my shoes on, you know what I mean, to save some time. You know, when I hear Ray Adam, that's it. I'm running. You know, and so you know, my first drink of alcohol. You know, my first drink. You know, My first drunk, actually. Well, not my first drink, but my first drunk came around the age of 12. And I remember when I drank it, it took that nervousness, that fear away. Man, I don't know, something happened. It was just like a light switch, you know, I like to say. And from there on, everything was history. You know, I'm not going to... Okay, I'm gonna speed up a little bit of what it was like. You know, I've been hospitalized twice. Well, no, several times I've been hospitalized, but twice for a coma, and a coma due to liver failure. You know, I've also been hospitalized for overdosing on cocaine. You know, and that story was a trippy one, man. It was a real trip one. You know, I remember. I remember I was up for like, it was my third day, and I did a line, I don't know, about this big, you know. And I remember walking out of my mom's house, and I said, Mom, I'll see you later, and that's all I remember. And next thing I remember, I'm in the ambulance, and they're telling me, you know, hold on, hang in there. And I'm thinking, okay, fuck, hang on to what, you know, what the hell happened? Anyways, I remember wanting to leave. I remember wanting to leave the hospital. I remember wanting to leave, and the doctor said, you know, you suffered some real damage to your heart, you know, this and that. And I said, I really don't care, you know, whatever, you know. And so I remember they let me go. And I remember the nurse telling me, you're free to leave, you know. And I'm like, okay, well, where's my clothes? And they're like, well, you didn't have any clothes. You know, they tore it off when it was in the ambulance, I guess. You know, and they said, well, you don't have any clothes. I said, well... I said, I guess I'm just going to leave like this. She goes, no, you have to take out the gown. I said, no, what do you mean? I said, all I have is my boxers. Look, I mean, and she said, you know, if you don't leave right now, you know, I'm going to call security on you. You know, and I'm like, well, how in the fuck am I going to do this? You know, I don't remember. I remember it was nighttime. I really don't remember what time it was, you know. And there was one nurse that said, hear me, just put this on. And she gave me a gown. And so I said, cool, man, so how am I going to do this? Can I go through the back or to the front? You know, I'm already thinking about how am I going to call home to or somewhere to get right. So she said, just go out through the lobby, through the waiting room area. And so I'm walking out. And as I walk out, I look up, and there's this whole family of people that I know. And they're like, hey, what are you doing here? You know what I mean? And I'm like all embarrassed walking, you know, have a gown and stuff like that. Just embarrassed, man. I remember what I told them, man, but that was just embarrassing. You know, it was just looking back at it, it's funny, you know. You know, I've been in treatment 8 times, at least 8 that I can remember. I've been in jail several times, and it's weird on how they say, you know, God works in mysterious ways. You know, Real quick on what it was like, real quick, just what it was like. I remember in my drinking days, you know, getting out of the hospital. I remember this last time, you know, getting out of the hospital, and you know, I remember, you know, they said, you know, you're free to go or whatever, And I remember that I was gonna get out. I'm losing my train of thought. Sorry. And I remember feeling very scared because the other times that I got out of the hospital, I started drinking, and by this time, you know, I'm divorced. I had lost my job. I had lost everything, you know, and I had absconded from drug court. You know what I mean? And I knew that it was just a matter of time before they were going to pick me up and have the remainder of my time, you know, back in the prison. And I remember doing what they had suggested in the program. I remember that, you know, they had told me to just pray, just pray, just pray. So I carried my IV thing into the restroom at the in the hospital, you know, and I got down on my knees. And I said, you know what? I don't know who you are, what you are. I don't know, you know. I just don't know. Please help, you know. And I remember walking out of there scared. I remember walking out of the hospital scared, and hitting my first AA meeting, and still not knowing if I was gonna stay sober or not. You know, it was just weird. And I went to this meeting in San Javier, and that's where I met Mondo. And in passing, we just said, "Hey, what's up, man?" And the way he looked at me, I'm thinking, "Man, this dude doesn't like me." You know what I mean? And so after the meeting, you know, he takes off, and I'm driving down the road, and his car's broken down. He had run out of gas, and so I pulled over. I took him to go get some gas and came back, and our friendship started. You know what I mean? He went on to be my AA road dog. You know what I mean? People, you know, and it's funny the way things work. You know, I started working steps with a sponsor, and I remember my first couple of months, man, I was walking around like if I was just gonna bust out of my skin, like if I was just gonna go crazy, you know. And I remember calling my sponsor, and he would tell me, you know, just concentrate on what you're doing there. Just concentrate on what you're doing in front of you at that point in time. You know what I mean? So I remember walking to the bus stop, counting my steps, because I was going absolutely crazy, you know. And I remember just in the bus opening up whatever magazine was there and just looking at the letters, not really reading, but just looking at the letters, you know what I mean? And because at that time I was just going crazy, I was just going insane, I was just going crazy, you know. And God works in mysterious ways. Like I keep on saying, you know, I'm working my steps. You know, at this time I'm living off the reservation, and something happens where I had to move back to my mom's house in the reservation. And by that time I was about a year sober. I'm thinking, oh, that's it, man. My sober days are numbered. You know, there's absolutely no way I can stay sober in the reservation. There's just absolutely no way. You know, I remember talking to my sponsor about it, and he just told me, you know, you gotta, no matter where you're at, you're always looking to be where you could be of maximum service, you know, to others and to your higher power. And so I started going to the Free Spirit group, you know, and then Mondo started coming along, then Julio started coming along, and everything just took off, man. You know, everything took off. But even before that meeting, before I started attending the meeting, I would attend other meetings outside, like at the Little House and other young people's, you know, groups and stuff like that. And I would think, man, how can I bring this over to the south side, to the southwest side, or to the reservation? You know, how can I do that? And it's strange because I didn't do nothing. Looking back at it, I didn't do nothing. All I did was just willing to keep on going to that meeting that I was at. Everything just fell in place. Everything just fell in place. You know, and I started working my steps, and I started doing, you know, my fourth and fifth. It's a trip, man, because, you know, I was doing, you know, when you do your amends and stuff like that, well, it's kind of like the timelines, I kind of have them mixed up. But I started working at the Casino del Sol. And at the Casino del Sol, it requires a background check. You know, it requires a background check. So I said, you know, how am I gonna do it? You know, with the charge that I know I have pending. I know I have pending because I didn't go to court for it. You know, and the only reason why I didn't go to court was because that was a county charge. And when the court day came up, I was in the federal. I was in timeout, you know, and that's why I know I didn't make that court date. So anyways, they did the background check and stuff like that, and it didn't come out. It just didn't come up. And I'm over there talking. I went to the courthouse. I gave them my name, and I gave them everything and my ID. I said, no, but, you know, that was that charge. They're like, well, we have nothing. I said, great, higher power, you know. And so, you know, I remember doing my fourth step. I remember doing my fourth step with my sponsor and everything, and I remember telling them absolutely everything. But I'm thinking, wait a minute. There's a lot of stuff that I haven't told them. You know, there's a lot of stuff that I haven't told them. So what I did is I went to confession at Santa Beer. I put everything down on a sheet. Everything down, everything wrong that I've done to others. It wasn't like the four step where it was the resentments and the fears and everything. It's just basically where I've hurt others, just straight out, just like that. And I remember talking to the priest, and the priest said, you know, wow. And he had tears in his eyes. And I did whatever I had to do. And that day I was going home. You know, I went to go pick up my kids because I had dropped them off, and I was going home. And I had stopped at Circle K. And I remember going in and getting a thirst buster. And as I'm walking out, there's a sheriff waiting for me right there. And he goes, excuse me, is your name Ray Baltazar? I said, yes, sir. Put your hands behind your back. And I'm like, you know, for what? Put them behind your back, sir. You know what I mean? I could already see him, you know, trying to size me up and stuff like that. I said, cool. I'm cool, man. What's going on? And I get arrested. I get arrested for that charge that they couldn't find, you know, when they were doing the background check. And what's weird is that it came after my confession, after the fifth step with the priest. And I'm thinking, you motherfucking priest. You motherfucker, man. And the only thing that I can think of in the ride to Connie is, don't say a damn thing, you know, until I know what that charge is, you know, because at this time I really don't know, because he wouldn't tell me, you know. I remember that. Yeah, I remember asking him, you know, this and that. He goes, well, all I know is for this and this, but I really can't tell you until you get over there. And I remember thinking, okay, don't say a damn thing. Well, anyways, they wound up giving me a plea. I paid a hefty fine, and I reported it to Tribal Gaming Office, and they said, okay, it's cool. As long as you report it, everything's good, you know, this and that. And so, you know, it's a trip on, like I said, you know, God works in mysterious ways, you know. Well, so I'm working the steps, and my ninth step, there's this one ninth step that I just know, I don't know how I'm going to handle. You see, because when me and this dude, we see each other, there's not going to be any words I or whatever. See, there's a little history between me and this guy. You see, up to that time, I went up to my employers. I told them I'm sorry. You know what I mean? There's other places that I couldn't just go up and say, I'm sorry, I fucking robbed you guys' mind or whatever. You know, I couldn't do that. But I made amends other ways, donations and things like that. Went up to my mom, you know, my family, my kids, my ex-wife, everybody. It's just this one person. And I know this one person was getting out soon. And what happened between me and this one person is, while I was in federal custody, it's weird on how politics in there works and how you can get involved without knowing you're going to get involved. Anyways. Me and this guy, we wound up being in this cell alone, man. And you're talking about a fight for your life. You know what I mean? This guy was like at least 6'6". And as a result of that, you know, they throw me into segregation, what they call the hole. And so I'm over here communicating with these people, you know, through little notes that you can fish. You know, and they're saying, yeah, you know, when you go back to this, it's going to pop off and this and that. I say, cool, well, fuck it. Let's do it. You know, let's do it. You just can't. I mean, I'm scared, but, you know, in there, you just cannot. You might as well just stay where you're at, you know, if you're not going to go out there and handle business. So that's just that little history right there, you know. anyways, I know he's getting out because I hear it. You know what I mean? I'm at the gym. I'm doing my push-ups, you know. I'm doing everything, calisthenics. And I'm in the A and thinking, God, you know, how am I going to handle this? And so I see him. I see this guy, and we're in the room, you know, and we're at that gym. And I'm thinking, all right, cool. You know what I mean? And so we're looking at each other and shit like that. And he comes up to me. And he goes, hey, what's up, man? I said, what's up, man? He goes, you know what happens in there is pretty fucked up, right? I said, yeah. My heart's pounding. My heart's right here in my neck, you know what I mean? But I'm not showing it, you know? And he goes, hey, why don't we quash it? And I'm thinking, really? You know, in my head. I didn't say that, but I'm like, cool. You know, because I'm trying to go another direction in my life, man, you know, or whatever, you know. And he's like, cool. So he gave me his hand. I didn't have to do anything. You know, he came up to me. You know, this person, I mean, and I don't want, you know, he's up for two lifetimes for double homicide on other people. You know, and it's just weird on how God works in mysterious ways, because I couldn't do these things myself. You know, I just couldn't do these things myself. You know, I remember back when I was in the hospital, I was in the psych ward at St. Mary's. It was weird because I had an out-of-body experience. I remember standing in the damn window. I don't know if it was the drugs or whatever, man, but I don't know if you guys ever been in 2 North in St. Mary's, but there's this window where you can see out there to Silverbell. And I remember just looking out thinking, I don't belong here. What am I doing here, you know? There's people walking around talking to themselves over here. There's another person over here, you know, thinking, I don't know. And I'm just thinking, how in the hell did this happen, you know? I forgot where I was going on that. Sorry. But anyways, going back sometime. I remember I was being transported to the hospital. I remember, I'm jumping all over the place, but I remember going to the hospital, and one of the EMTs happens to be one of my friends, and I'm thinking, how'd you become an EMT, man? You used to fucking party all the damn time, you know. You used to be like this, and you used to be like this. So I remember looking at him, and I don't remember what happened. All I remember, I was bouncing off the walls. I was bouncing off the damn walls. So next thing you know, I remember that night, the security guards came, and they strapped me to the gurney. And I remember I was crying so much. I was in depression that, I mean, I was just, I could see through my tears, and I could see him walking out the door. My friend, the EMT, walking out the door from St. Mary's Hospital. And I was thinking, why can't I be like that? Why can't I live a normal life? Why can't I be a stand-up citizen? Why can't I just be normal? You know what I mean? And the reason I bring this up is I've had that opportunity. You know what I mean? Just by that memory, you know, I enrolled into Arizona MedTech. You know, I got certified to be an EMT. And I had an opportunity to go to the Firefighter Academy. You know, see, God works in mysterious ways. But I didn't follow through with that Firefighter Academy. I did not, because the job where I was working at, where I'm currently working at now, Casino del Sol, I remember sitting down with my director and telling him, hey, listen, I'll probably be cutting out from Casino, you know, because, you know, I got this offer over here for the Firefighter Academy. And he says, well, I want you to think about this, man. You've been such a good worker, you know, all these, you know, past couple of years or whatever. You've only missed a couple of days or whatever. You know, you're a pretty stand-up guy. He goes, I want you to think about a position in management. And I said, well, let me think about it. You know, I'm really interested in this and this and that. And he says, okay, well, here it is, man. Here's the training. Here's the training guidelines in management. You know, this is the schools that I'm going to be sending to you. And this is the starting pay. And I said, okay, I'm in. You know what I mean? I'm in. You know, and so I've been blessed. You know, I've been blessed. You know, There's just times like yesterday when I'm sitting here thinking, oh my God, you know, how much my life has changed. You know, I can remember the time that I was sitting at the hospital. I mean, I was standing outside in the window of the hospital. I can remember the time that I was in the dog kennel when I was in the hole, in segregation. And I'm here now. It's just like my life is just so different, night and day. You know, since then, you know, I have custody of my son. I remember for the first maybe 6 months, I couldn't even see him. You know, I now have custody of him. We have a home. You know, I have a beautiful 3-month-old daughter and in this awesome relationship, this girlfriend, who's just awesome. And I've been able to take my niece and nephew, and I took custody of them, you know, because my sister's out there. She's struggling, you know, so I just had a long talk with my sister, and I took my two nephews in, you see. So for me to be able to do that, that's just awesome, you know. It's a result of me staying sober. How many times did I want to give up? Damn, how many times I wanted to give up. I remember thinking, man, I wonder if the people with 10 years, 5 years, 4 years, 6 months, 9 months, I wonder if they feel like I do and just want to give up. You know, and I'm just glad I didn't. You know, there was just times where I was just barely hanging on, but I didn't, because if I would have gave up, I wouldn't have had what I have now. And it just keeps on getting better. You know, there's a lot of people that says, yo, you know, I miss being a newcomer, because life at that time was spunking. I was full of whatever, and I was out there doing this and that. Well, I don't know about for you guys, but for me, it's still like that. You know, and probably even more so, because I don't have to deal with all these crazy thoughts and emotions that come. They still come, but, you know, I know how to deal with them now. You know, and I just, it's just a trip, man, on the group that I run with now. It's like we're a group who normally would not mix. And it is true, you know, it is true. But I wouldn't change it. You know, and these are the best friends that I had. You know, when my brother was shot and killed back in May, you know, my home group, they were there. You know, they didn't let me fall to either side. You know, they held me up. And honestly, man, those days I remember taking it just a thought at a time. Man. You know, and I've thought about drinking, you know, in those days. It was close. It was close. But thank God for my home group, you know. And, you know, anyways, I'm sorry, guys. I know I was all over the place trying to make sense of, you know, what story I told and everything, you know. And anyways, guys, thank you.
Thanks, everyone. It's good to hear your stories. Where are we? The Wacky Paw 15 Host Committee would like to thank all of the conference participants and attendees for making this weekend possible and magical. The next panel meeting in this room will begin at 3:30, and the topic is how to get it on in AA. And please help me thank our speakers and readers again. And after a moment of silence for the alcoholic who still suffers, Annie will lead us out with a prayer of your choice.